It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the government gave out billions of dollars in contracts for medical supplies during the pandemic. Not all of that money was used honestly. We'll talk to the author of a new book on pandemic-era fraud. First, the Food and Drug Administration released its proposal last week to ban menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. The FDA says the ban would reduce the number of young people who start smoking and help current smokers quit. It would also address health disparities by race and socioeconomic status. The tobacco industry is expected to challenge the ban, which would represent one of the largest regulations of their products in at least the last decade. We're learning more about the potential impacts of that kind of ban, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the FDA should ban menthol cigarettes and or flavored cigars? Should the FDA take more steps to regulate tobacco products? What regulations would you like to see? What questions do you have about who uses these kind of products? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah Mills is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Behavior at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She studies tobacco use and racial and socioeconomic health disparities, and she's looking at the possible impact of a menthol ban. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, how widely used are these products, the menthol cigarettes and the flavored cigars?
Well, about one third of smokers in the United States use menthol cigarettes. That's about 18 million people who use menthol cigarettes here.
What do we know about who is using them? Which demographic groups seem to use these menthol cigarettes in particular most?
Sure. Menthol cigarettes are used by about 85% of Black smokers as compared to 30% of white smokers. So there's stark racial disparities in use of menthol cigarettes, and this is a result of targeted marketing by the tobacco industry. Menthol cigarettes are also used at higher rates among people with lower incomes.
Let's talk more about the marketing. I know there have been campaigns in Milwaukee and other big cities around the country trying to give some kind of restrictions to the marketing of these products. What do we see when we look out there? How disproportionately are these products targeting Black smokers in particular?
Yeah, so targeted marketing by the tobacco industry of menthol cigarettes to Black communities in particular has gone on for decades and continues today. My own research finds that tobacco retailers in neighborhoods with a greater percentage of Black residents have more advertising for menthol cigarettes and cheaper prices for Newport menthol cigarettes, which is the most popular menthol cigarette brand. And what this does is it increases access to the product.
And now I just said marketing targeted to Black smokers. I guess a big part of the story here is, how much does this marketing affect non-smokers? How much of this is the way that people get onboarded, get brought into smoking in the first place?
That's a great point. So marketing study shows makes it more difficult for smokers to quit because they're constantly being reminded of tobacco. And it also increases smoking among youth. And so, we're not only concerned about our smokers, but we're also interested in tobacco control and prevention and reducing youth smoking rates and trying to prevent them from using a cigarette at all.
Talking to Sarah Mills, who researches health behavior at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, looking at a proposed ban on menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars proposed by the FDA. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions on that, maybe your experiences, maybe the ads you see in your own community at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, for those who haven't smoked cigarettes, what is it about menthol cigarettes? What is the specific appeal there?
Right. So menthol is an additive, and it's found in a number of products. It's found in shampoos, toothpaste. But when added to cigarettes, the analgesic and cooling effects of menthol help to mask the harshness of cigarette smoke. And this facilitates initiation. Menthol cigarettes are considered a starter product for youth. And the analgesic and cooling effects of menthol that help reduce that harshness of cigarette smoke makes it easier for youth to to start using the product. And about 50% of youth, when they start smoking, they start with a menthol cigarette.
So to put it in really literal terms, that first drag of a cigarette, if it's from a menthol one, because of that slight numbing property, I'm less likely to gag on it?
Yep, that's correct.
Hmm.
Studies find...
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And so in addition to these, to facilitating initiation, menthol cigarettes are also more difficult to quit than non-menthol cigarettes. And that's a problem because if you're less likely to quit, that in turn increases your likelihood of dying from tobacco-related disease.
And a key point here, I think people may have the sense, since it feels like it's smoother and less harsh, people might come away with the impression that a menthol cigarette is less unhealthy than a regular cigarette. That is not at all true, correct?
That's correct. There are studies that look at perceptions of the harm caused by menthol cigarettes as compared to non-menthol cigarettes. And individuals do believe that it's less harmful, but that's not the case at all. And actually, because they're more difficult to quit, they are considered more harmful than non-menthol cigarettes.
You are, I believe, currently engaged in research on the possible impact of a menthol cigarette ban. What kind of things are you looking at?
So I'm developing a simulation model to estimate the public health impact of a menthol cigarette ban on tobacco use and tobacco-related disease. And this work is part of a growing literature base that's using simulation to estimate the impacts of tobacco control policies. Right now, there are already simulation models out there that estimate that over a 40-year period, up to 640,000 deaths in the United States would be averted if a national menthol cigarette ban were implemented.
We're talking about the FDA's proposed menthol cigarette and flavored cigar ban. Sarah Mills is with us, public health professor at the University of North Carolina, who studies, among other things, disparities in tobacco use and public health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a current or former smoker, were menthol cigarettes or flavored cigars some of your earliest experiences with smoking? What do you think in general about this idea of the FDA banning these products? Do you see a lot of marketing in your community for these flavored tobacco products? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with University of North Carolina public health professor Sarah Mills. With us today, looking at the health disparities in menthol cigarette use and the potential impact of an FDA ban proposed by the agency on menthol cigarettes as well as flavored cigars. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that idea, your thoughts, your experiences. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to Kimberly in Arena now. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So my boyfriend, he's trying to quit smoking, but when he was first starting, when he wouldn't use his credit card to buy the types of cigarettes that he buys, within a week he would get coupons in the mail for that particular brand of cigarettes that would be like $3 off or something. And I remember one time I bought him a pack of cigarettes, and I started getting those in the mail probably weekly for about 2 months.
Interesting, Kimberly. Thank you for sharing that with us. Sarah, I think of a cigarette advertising as the billboard or the sign in front of the store. It can be, Kimberly says, a little more subtle than that.
The tobacco industry now spends the majority of its marketing doing things just like that, sending coupons, and having price promotions like 2-for-1 deals that reduce the price of cigarettes and essentially increasing access to the product. Within tobacco control, one of our most effective interventions is to reduce smoking prevalence is to increase the price of tobacco products. And so the tobacco industry uses its marketing funding to keep prices low and keep access of these products to the public.
Thanks for that call, Kimberly, at 800-642-1234. Sarah, I've seen some concerns about how this might be enforced, especially if it focuses police attention on Black communities where these cigarettes are being sold. Do you have concerns about that, that there would be unintended consequences that would fall on the people that you're hoping to help with, or that people are hoping to help with this ban?
The tobacco industry is pushing these false claims that a menthol cigarette ban will subject Black Americans to more law enforcement abuse. The Food and Drug Administration is planning to ban the manufacture and sale of the product, and they're not planning to criminalize possession or use of the product. For years, the tobacco industry has funded organizations and prominent spokespeople to try to leverage real concern about law enforcement abuses into opposition to prohibiting menthol cigarettes. And this fear-mongering cannot hide the fact that it is the industry itself that has caused so much harm to Black Americans through their targeted marketing of this product. Racial bias in policing is an urgent problem that must be addressed. And the tobacco industry's targeting of the Black community with menthol cigarettes and the enormous harm that it has caused must also be addressed. We can and we must do both. This proposed ruling is not about criminalizing Black smokers. It's about saving Black lives.
Now, we heard from Reed in New Berlin, who wanted to know more about the science between menthol being more dangerous. I think you had said earlier, Sarah, that menthol cigarettes, people have a harder time quitting smoking them. Why would that be?
So there's different, I'm not a biologist, but there's different ideas about hypotheses about why menthol cigarettes in particular makes it more difficult to quit. One is that because menthol reduces the harshness of cigarette smoke, individuals are able to inhale the smoke more deeply. And this results in greater nicotine dependence. And it's nicotine dependence that drives addiction and makes it more difficult to quit.
Now, we have some precedent here, I understand, Sarah. There used to be other flavors of cigarettes, you know, like a berry flavor, the sort of things you might see in these flavored cigars. Have we learned anything from the impact of banning those other non-menthol flavors of cigarettes?
So in 2009, under the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, all flavored cigarettes were banned except for menthol. And the reason why these flavors were banned is because flavors attract youth. And we have seen continuous reductions in youth smoking prevalence over time. And so the tobacco industry, of course, did not want to, wanted to exempt menthol from that ruling in 2009 because the most popular flavor of cigarettes is menthol cigarettes. But to continue to prevent youth smoking and to reduce the harm that tobacco causes to the public health, it's critical to also ban menthol cigarettes.
Let's get to the outcomes now. What do we know about health disparities that the availability and the marketing of these products, these menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars, has on, as you mentioned earlier, Black communities and low-income communities?
So Black adults suffer the most from tobacco-related disease and mortality. They have the highest incidence and death rates from tobacco-related disease and mortality. And this is believed to be in part driven by their disproportionate use of menthol cigarettes. And so by banning this product, we think that we'll not only save lives overall in the total U.S. population, but we'll also see a disproportionate impact and positive public health impact in the Black community.
What would be a timeline if this is a proposed ban? What is the timeline from now until something like this coming into reality?
So this past week, FDA issued a proposed ruling. There'll be a comment period for several months where the public is able to comment on this proposed ruling. FDA then needs to review all comments. FDA reviews every single comment made. That can take several months. After that, a rule would be finalized. And then there's typically a 12-month period before the effective date of a policy after a rule is finalized. So I'd say we're at least a year and some months away from the ban taking effect. However, the tobacco industry will likely sue, and that would delay the ban for longer.
And briefly, Sarah, I know another angle people have pursued is trying to cut down on marketing of these products. Do you see that as something that might be useful?
I do. Studies show that marketing is associated with tobacco use, cravings, and relapse. And so by restricting marketing, that is another tobacco control intervention that we can use to help reduce smoking prevalence.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Sarah Mills, assistant professor in the Department of Health Behavior at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She was with us today for a look at the possible impact of a proposed ban on menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Let us know what you think, maybe your own experiences, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Four years ago, an explosion at the Husky Energy Oil Refinery in Superior injured dozens of workers and forced a temporary evacuation of city residents. Now, documents obtained by WPR from federal regulators shed new light on what refinery officials knew leading up to the blast. As Danielle Kading reports, the refinery knew about erosion on a key piece of equipment a decade before the explosion.
The Superior Oil Refinery has operated in the city since 1950. Now, construction is ongoing behind me, just a few miles from Lake Superior. The refinery's towers and tanks are still here, but there are cranes and contractors working on rebuilding the plant after an explosion 4 years ago. Most of the workers were on break when the explosion hit. Even so, three dozen people reported injuries that range from spinal fractures to minor cuts and bruises. Attorney Kyle Finley represents nine contractors who are suing the refinery for medical costs and lost wages.
The impact it had, the hard hats being blown off, people knocked off scaffolding. I mean, it's a very traumatic event.
That night, refinery manager Colin Shady told reporters that the blast took place as the facility was shutting down for maintenance.
Throughout 2013, we did a similar event where we shut the entire refinery down. We go inside every vessel and we check everything for mechanical integrity.
The U.S. Chemical Safety Board said a worn valve likely caused the blast by allowing air to flow backwards inside a unit that's important for producing gasoline. And an investigation by federal labor regulators found the refinery could have prevented the explosion if it had properly maintained critical equipment. WPR obtained more than 1,300 pages of documents from that investigation by the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. They reveal the refinery knew about problems with erosion on that key valve a decade before the explosion. OSHA found the worn valve had been repaired during the refinery's last shutdown in 2013, and the one before that had been rebuilt in 2008. Holes in the valve were found during both shutdowns, and refinery workers knew the valve could leak because of erosion. In the final hours before the blast, workers reported hearing two booms from inside a refinery control room. Documents show the plant's operators and supervisors didn't fully investigate what had caused them. Finley says evidence shows things were going wrong for a long time.
When you don't take the precautions, exactly what you think will happen, and that is an explosion.
OSHA found the refinery should have inspected the valve more frequently and changed it out sooner. And the agency found no documented inspections of repairs to that valve by the refinery during the last two shutdowns. Operator logs also showed the worn valve was malfunctioning in the days leading up to the explosion. Plant managers had changed its shutdown procedure just a day before the incident and hadn't given operators adequate training. Jordan Barab served as OSHA's assistant deputy secretary during the Obama administration. He says it's not uncommon to see procedures and training that don't keep up with changes at refineries.
Rewriting procedures and retraining workers and all that kind of stuff is not something that directly leads to a profit. It's easy to cut corners there.
Barab says it's important to have strong involvement from workers or unions to promote safety. WPR reached out to 9 contract companies on site that day and 4 local union representatives, but none agreed to speak publicly. Atticus Larson is a refinery electrician and member of the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 420. In late 2018, Larson said during a Chemical Safety Board meeting in Superior that no price can be put on safety.
Did people think safety was expensive before? Look what it costs us now. We need to start using the most up-to-date safety standards that have been in the industry for years. The most important thing, period, is for everyone to go home safely after every shift to their family.
Last year, Husky merged with Cenovus Energy in a roughly $5 billion deal. In an earnings call last week, the company said the $1.2 billion rebuild has the refinery on track to resume normal operations early next year. A Cenovus spokesperson said in a statement that the refinery is being rebuilt with state-of-the-art equipment. That includes new slide valves. The lawsuit from contractors who were caught in the 2018 explosion is still ongoing. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, the Justice Department continues to investigate the misuse of federal contracts given out during the pandemic for key medical supplies. A journalist and author of a new book joins us to share what he's found in 2 years of covering pandemic-related fraud, how we got there, what's being done about it now. Remember, you can follow great conversations like these anytime over at WPR.org, stream live, check out the archives, and share your favorite conversations with friends and family. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app and listen wherever you go. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a leaked draft opinion shows there's likely enough support in the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. We'll talk about the significance of the leak and what it tells us about the future of abortion rights in the United States. Now, in an effort to produce more protective gear at the start of the pandemic, the federal government gave out contracts to businesses who promised to produce or obtain those products, things like hospital-grade N95 masks, among other things. Many of those businesses had never dealt with medical equipment or masks before. Some never followed through with their contracts or tried to pass off inferior equipment as the real deal. Our next guest investigated many of the companies involved and the chaotic effort by government agencies that helped make fraud possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how all this happened? Were you in an agency, a hospital, a health clinic? I was trying to get your hands on things like masks and other protective gear in the early days of the pandemic. What kind of things did you run across? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David McSwain is a ProPublica reporter and author of the new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's set the stage a little bit here. Talk about the situation early in the pandemic. We knew we were going to need a lot of these supplies. The federal government didn't have them. Talk about the scramble to try to get this stuff that made so much of this fraud you write about possible.
Yeah, so we had this sort of perfect storm. When COVID hit, we had something like 1% of what we needed in the strategic national stockpile in terms of masks and gloves. Sort of as a result of 10 years of sort of political fighting. And on top of that, you had the Trump administration, which was really slow to react to the pandemic and really trying to downplay it. And by the time the federal government tried to catch up, the national strategy really became to throw money at anyone and everyone who claimed they could get their hands on these things. And we saw companies, you know, forming overnight and just a few days later having multi-million dollar contracts with the federal government for things like N95s. And I just started following them around and calling people up, and it set off about a year and a half of reporting into this weird underworld of brokers and investors and people who tried to take the federal government and states for a ride while taxpayers got screwed.
You went for a ride with one of the first people you talked about this, a guy named Robert Stewart Jr. He got this big $30+ million contract to produce 6 million, or not produce, somehow obtain 6 million N95 masks. And he was like a guy. He had no background to this stuff. Tell us how you entered into this story.
Yeah, so this was April 2020. I was trying to find my place in the coverage and decided to follow the money here from Washington, D.C. and started looking at who the, you know, some of the bigger contracts were going to, and looked in at the Veterans Administration, which oversees the largest hospital network in the country, where nurses and doctors were scrambling and making their own PPE. And as you said, he had no background in this. So I called him and just asked, how do you have 6 million N95s when no one seems to be able to get these things? And he says, well, yeah, I'm legitimate. I'm the real deal. I'm hopping on a private jet in the morning to oversee their delivery. And I said, that's amazing. Would you mind if I tagged along? And, you know, just hours later, I'm on a private jet. And literally, as we're taking off, he, you know, he reveals that he doesn't actually have the masks, that we're kind of working on a wing and a prayer. And he's working with these people. He called them buccaneers and pirates, these brokers who were, you know, trying to get rich off of the mad scramble for supplies. And over 36 hours, just came to realize that, you know, he may have been committing a federal crime before my eyes, and the whole thing may have been made up.
What was going on in D.C., in the Veterans Administration, the other federal agencies who were reaching out to people like this and saying, yeah, sure, $34 million contract, get us those masks?
Well, in his case, I came to find out later, it took quite a while to confirm this, he was awarded a $34.5 million contract based on an email. He said, hey, I've got masks. And somebody, a contract officer at the VA said, quote, the guy looks legit. And that's how he got his contract. And we were seeing, just following the contracts at ProPublica, and I tracked these down in the book, that, you know, there was no real vetting going on. Anyone with an LLC and an email address could get a multi-million dollar contract, because we were that desperate, and federal agencies were just panic buying.
Now, before we get into some of the more outright examples of fraud, even if we stop there with all these people who, you know, overpromised and delivered nothing, you had states, you had hospitals, you had the federal agencies trying to get this stuff. Were we just creating a market of more and more people creating demand for masks that didn't exist and driving up prices?
Absolutely. I mean, the federal government, in just that one example we've talked about, signaled to this black market that they were willing to pay almost $6 per mask when they used to cost about a dollar. So that just created this bonanza for middlemen, brokers who wanted in on the action, and that set the price for masks. And you have states and cities and hospitals all competing for the same supplies, which, you know, people are trying to bring in from China to get rich.
Talking to David McSwain about his new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about pandemic fraud, maybe an experience. If you were trying to procure for a health clinic, a government agency, whatever, PPE, masks, and more stuff, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's bring on a caller now. Nate is with us in Eau Claire. Nate, hi.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm a physician and work at a hospital in Eau Claire. We were really completely out of all supplies. We didn't end up buying supplies from, you know, from middlemen from China. I myself had physician friends in China who wanted to send me masks and did send me masks. But, you know, to get them FedEx here was almost $3 or $4 a mask. So on one hand, we can complain that masks were $6, but at the other side of the equation, at least we could buy them. The government was completely unprepared, had done nothing to help us, physicians and hospitals, and left us in the lurch. And basically, you can look at the contracting from the VA and stuff, but that had, you know, they really weren't there to help anybody for 9 months or a year. We were all on our own and lucky to buy masks at $6 each and could hardly get them.
Nate, thanks so much for sharing that experience. David, there are probably thousands of Nates around the country in that same boat at that time, right?
Right. Yeah. So you're left to navigate this sort of shady underworld. It's lucky that Nate had some connections with folks in China. Most places didn't know how to navigate that, and they were waiting on the federal government to get it together.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Nate, at 800-642-1234. That China connection, David, you looked at different operations who were trying to bring in masks from China. Can you tell us about one? I think this was in Texas where they brought the masks, but they changed the labels through the process.
Right. So to fill the gap, the FDA and the CDC sort of put together this really haphazard system where they were approving certain masks, the KN95s, you know, the Chinese version, which, you know, generally aren't as good. Their efficacy was always sort of questionable. And, you know, people saw an opportunity to, if they could bring in those KN95s, they could also make money. The problem was a lot of them were nowhere near the 95% filtration rate of an actual N95. And in fact, many were pretty lousy. And in Texas, I found a ring of guys who were using Venmo and TaskRabbit paying each other to take subpar masks out of their packaging that clearly stated not for medical use and put them into different packaging so that they could pass muster with Texas hospitals. And just following Venmo, I was able to see how these folks were paying each other for repackaging, you know, to try to get in on the frenzy.
You met some of the people running these operations, some who had worked for them through TaskRabbit and some who had left once they realized it was pretty sketchy. Talk about, how did they talk about this? Did they say, yeah, I'm doing kind of this scam, but it's cool? Or did they not realize they were doing something bad?
I mean, some folks did realize that it was bad. I mean, that's how I came to know about the story. Somebody had told a friend who told me. But one of the central figures in that effort down there in San Antonio really didn't seem to think it was much of a problem. You know, he just thought it was a matter of cutting through some red tape. And I said, you know, these are destined for nurses and doctors. It seems pretty important that they know whether or not they're medical grade or not, because at this point we don't have a vaccine and hospitals are overrun, particularly in Texas at that point in time. And it seemed as I was explaining my concern, he slowly started to realize that maybe he'd been involved in something shady. And, you know, he eventually stopped talking to me.
And there are so many details in your book that are kind of funny. I mean, apart from, you know, the potential health consequences, you mentioned Venmo. If I don't use Venmo, but if I did, there's a thing I can do where I can make my notes private. All the people in these shady dealings in that story you just told, you were able to track down where they're taking things from and to, because they left their notes public.
God bless them. They left it public and even post some on social media. That app has since changed it so that it's a little bit harder to track other people's public transactions, which is a shame.
We're talking to David McSwain, ProPublica reporter, author of the book Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. He's talking with us about how some people use the COVID-19 pandemic as a way to secure business contracts and make money, in some cases through outright fraud. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there should be more accountability for people involved in these contracts? We'll get into what has happened to some of them in just a few moments. Do you have an experience? Were you on the hunt for some of these products on the secondary, sometimes dubious market for personal protective equipment and masks back in early 2020? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with David McSwain, ProPublica reporter, author of the new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. David's talking to us today about pandemic fraud. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. Maybe your experiences with trying to get equipment for a clinic, a hospital, whatever the case may be. 800-642-1234, back during the early days of the pandemic. David, one of the most fascinating people in your book was not one of the fraudsters, but a longtime mask manufacturer who had been sounding the alarm about our depleted stockpile of masks and kept trying to help through the pandemic. Can you share a little of his story with us?
Yeah, Mike Bowen, along with a business partner down near Dallas, Texas, ran a factory called Prestige Ameritech, which makes homegrown N95 respirators and surgical masks. And he'd been warning through letters and phone calls for over 13 years, three different administrations, really spelling out that if we were hit with a pandemic, China would cut off supply. Everything had been outsourced for cheaper labor and costs in China. They would choke that off, and you know, Americans would needlessly die. He'd been calling for the stockpile to beef up its investment in domestic manufacturing for that reason. And what was amazing about his story is he realized before almost anyone that we were in trouble, because this obscure corner of his website where the company sold N95s in smaller cases was blowing up, and they saw sales shooting through the roof. It looked like Chinese Americans might be sending these back home to China and Hong Kong. And he sounded the alarm, started telling people in Washington, and nearly got the ball rolling. But some politics here in Washington got in the way. But if we had listened to Mike Bowen, we would have had supplies and we would have had him earlier.
Another concern you raise in the book was that some politically connected figures were able to get pretty juicy contracts out of the White House and some federal agencies. What did you find?
I found that Peter Navarro, President Trump's trade advisor, who was behind some of his trade war efforts, had done something really remarkable. He essentially inserted himself into federal purchasing. He was one of the few in the administration to really sound the alarm early on. But he was also a China hawk and just this character. And he just started directing contracts to people who had he was connected to, or to people who had a line to the White House. So you have that sort of patronage stuff going on. At the same time, you have desperate agencies giving contracts out to anybody and everyone. So some of the people like Mike Bowen, who probably should have been hired and brought into the fray early, were on the sidelines as we were messing around with companies that had political connections or had no business at all getting a contract.
Among those were some companies where the owners had a history of various kinds of business fraud. How easy was it for people with a track record of doing fraud to get these contracts?
Incredibly easy. There's one company I detail in the book called Filicut LLC. This company formed in late April or early May 2020. 6 days later, got a $10 million deal with the Federal Emergency Management Agency for test tubes. And these are the PCR tests, you know, still very early, crucial weeks where we need to catch up on testing to get ahead of the virus. And we looked into the company. They had no history of medical supplies, so we immediately questioned their product. But the owner actually had a history of fraud allegations against him and had been sued by federal agencies, in fact, for that alleged fraud. And long story short, we put it into a story, and I end up visiting the warehouse down in Houston, and I approach after sort of staking the place out, and I can see that this company has temp workers using literal snow shovels rounding up these quote-unquote test tubes, which aren't test tubes at all. They're actually mini soda bottle preforms that are blown up with heat and pressure to create your two-liter soda bottles at the grocery store. And it's being done in these unsanitary conditions where fans are whipping things around, people aren't wearing masks. These tests are unusable. And when I told FEMA what I'd seen, they had been distributed to all 50 states and territories. FEMA had to tell those states and territories not to use those test kits. And it set back testing during those really crucial weeks where we were struggling to catch up on the virus. And because the federal government accepted the tubes, even though they were useless, that company got paid. And contract experts tell me it's hard to make a case that they should give the money back.
Talking to David McSwain about his new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. So, David, that company didn't see any accountability. Did others? Did anybody get successfully charged, imprisoned with fraud? I know at least one key story in your book that is what happened.
Yes, Robert Stewart Jr., the man with the private jet who sort of set me off on this quest, was eventually charged with three federal crimes and, you know, is in prison for his crimes, including defrauding some other government programs. Where, you know, a lot of people did get away with it. It was, you know, people who just didn't deliver things, they lost their contracts. But where we're seeing a lot of action now is within the Paycheck Protection Program, where people who own businesses, lied on a few forms, and were able to get millions of dollars within days. Hundreds of people have been charged for defrauding that program. We saw a lot of fraud in the unemployment benefits program as well. And, you know, President Biden in his State of the Union address announced that he was setting up a special prosecutor to investigate pandemic fraud. So, but each one of those has to be its own case where law enforcement gets involved and, you know, the wheels of justice are slow. So we're going to be catching up to this for years.
Yeah, what is the current state now of investigations of these companies that ripped off the government in one way or another?
You know, it's unclear. It's slow moving. Congress is looking into some of these companies, including several that I detail in the book. And we're seeing more reports, you know, every other month or so coming out on that. And as I said, there is a larger federal effort to catch up to the fraud because we're still in this thing. And, you know, the Biden administration was really focused on vaccine deployment and all those other things. So fraud sort of took a back seat.
What kind of lessons are you hoping people learn from the stories you report on?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, that this book is a blueprint of exactly what we shouldn't do when faced with such a crisis. You know, it's amazing to me that we only had 1% of what we needed in the stockpiles when COVID hit. We had clear warnings that we didn't heed. Our politics got in the way. I think those are some really simple things that we can address. We could put guardrails up on programs like the Paycheck Protection Program. That program, you know, by design, by Congress's design, placed speed above everything else. So money was just flying out the door, something like $800 billion in forgivable loans with almost no oversight and no incentive for banks and other lenders to vet the claims of these business owners. And as a result, we had this massive cleanup effort. So I think we need to think about those guardrails on how you release spending, who you contract with, make sure we're prepared so that we don't end up in a situation where our national well-being is in the hand of mercenaries ever again.
We've been talking about a lot about the money, money eventually, I guess, wasted by the government on a lot of these companies, money made by some of these people who ran these things. How about the impact, though, on health? How much did these fraudulent efforts hamper our reaction to the pandemic?
You know, the cause effect there is always going to, you know, we're never really going to pin that down because this was so big, so massive and so messy. You know, but what we do know is all of this fraud, all of this giving contracts to people who had no business getting contracts, the delays in testing, the delays in delivering masks, that all happened when time meant American lives. We needed this stuff and we needed it now. And our doctors and nurses were at risk while people were trying to get rich off of it. So the answer is too much human life was lost while these shenanigans I was following around transpired.
And you had to spend time one-on-one in the offices of some of these people who are committing various kinds of fraud or, in one case, a private plane. What are they like? What is it like to just hang out with these people who are knowingly, in some cases, semi-knowingly in others, ripping off the American government and endangering health?
Well, you know, I always come in with an open mind. I mean, we never know someone's motivations, and I try to hear people out and see what they say. And, you know, in the case of Robert Stewart Jr. with the private jet, I felt a tension in him as if he wasn't sure if he was the vaunted American entrepreneur, you know, that is rising to his occasion that we all, you know, sort of admire in this country, or if he in fact was one of the buccaneers and pirates he so decried. In other cases, it was pretty clear, you know, for instance, the test tube company, that owner came out and screamed at me and very threateningly. So you never know how it's going to go. But my job is just to show up and ask questions and see, you know, get as many answers as we can.
In our last 30 seconds or so, do you think that the federal government has learned any lessons for how to do quick procurement of vital supplies?
I certainly hope so. You know, the Biden administration has called for something like $88 billion to be infused into Health and Human Services, which includes the stockpile, the CDC, and other agencies, so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we have to deal with so much emergency contracting. But at the very least, you know, a quick Google search would have caught plenty of these, you know, these dubious contractors. And certainly you got to think about the effects you're going to have on a market that you can't control. Emergency managers would say this was a time when the government needed to take control through the Defense Production Act and make sure that prices were set and you couldn't price gouge and so forth.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David McSwain, a ProPublica reporter. We've been talking about his new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. He talked to us today about fraudulent companies getting government contracts, big ones, for key pandemic supplies. Thanks to everyone who donated over the course of our spring member drive over the last week. We got support from people like Margarita and Cudahy. That helps ensure that you and your entire community have access to trustworthy news, statewide conversations, and quality entertainment. If you did miss the drive, you're out of town or something, your gift now still makes a difference. Listeners like you play a vital role in keeping Wisconsin informed and connected. Thank you for supporting WPR's essential service with your donation at WPR.org. And on a personal note, thank you so much for saying you care enough about public radio to actually pony up some cash for it. Really do appreciate it and all the great comments that came up along the way. You're listening to Central Time.